Her name's Christine.
I like that.
Welcome to this review of Christine.
Probably the only thing my brother ever loved in his whole rotten life was that car. No shitter ever came between him and Christine. If they did, watch out.
Part of the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast, look at the films based on the work of author Stephen King.
You want it? Come get it!
Join Garrett.
Oh, this is Mr. Cool.
Matt.
God, I hate rock and roll.
And Adam.
Hey, you ain't mad, are you?
As they look at John Carpenter's 1983 adaptation of one of King's most memorable villains.
Talking about Christine, man! No shitter ever came between me and Christine.
And keep coming back, as these podcast hosts will continue going through each and every King adaptation in publication order.
Scout's honor.
So get ready, you shitters.
Come on, prick! We're not finished yet!
Percolated Media's review of Christine begins now.
Okay. Show me.
Christine, or John Carpenter's Christine, was released December 9th, 1983. Budget on this was $10 million, box office $21 million, and this was directed by John Carpenter. The Carps. Adam, we're finally getting to John Carpenter.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. Okay, so...
John Carpenter. Yay! It's Stephen King. Damn it!
Yeah, let's go over this leg of King that we've been doing this last month plus. Because, my God, we have done two of his most acclaimed adaptations, one of his most derided adaptations, one of his most controversial adaptations. And Matt, is it safe to assume this is one of his most iconic villains, right?
Iconic is a bit of a stretch, at least in my estimation, because when I think of Stephen King, I know of Christine, but I don't think it's one of like his most recognizable. I guess it is in a sense, because a haunted car is a stock, very stock type of villain. And at the same time, though, I think the other thing that benefited it was the time it came out. This was when we were starting to get the onslaught of King adaptations, you know, like this, Dead Zone. Shining was a couple years before this, so you were getting a lot more recognizability. But for me, this is also one of the books, I know I've read it because I love the cover that I had in the library when I was back in high school. It was the Christine font with like a decal that was a skull. It didn't even have the car on the front. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was about when I read it. I just saw Stephen King. I'm like, oh, I'll read this. And I tried that maybe about three more times that I said I'm never doing that again, because one of them was Dreamcatcher, and that wore me off looking at King books ever again unless someone gave me an actual recommendation. But yeah, I mean, it's the poster for this movie, I think, is discernible and recognizable.
Yep, very recognizable. Very incredible. This was my shit as a teenager. I loved Christine as a teenager, mostly because Dennis was me. I felt really like that was me in high school. And it's funny in watching this, because this was something I really loved the book. I've read it three or four times over my lifetime, read it again for this podcast. And it's an interesting read, because the beginning is told from Dennis, our character played by John Stockwell in this movie, told from his point of view, right? And then it just turns into third person for a little bit, right after the accident that happens on the football field, which also happens in the book. And then at the end, it goes right back into first person with Dennis. And I read an interview with King where he talked about that, where he said, yeah, I kind of ran into a problem because I kind of knocked the character telling the story out of commission. So I thought about maybe doing it as a hearsay, like maybe things that he heard that didn't really go anywhere. So I just went right to third person and then eventually caught up to him and he told the end of it. But unlike Stand By Me, which we covered last week, there are some major differences in this movie as opposed to the book. And Matt, you're certainly aware of those, right?
Mm-hmm. There's a big, I guess I would call it omission,
mm-hmm,
that kind of goes against the grain for a lot of King adaptations we've talked about and even his writing. So I'm curious, I'm going to guess Adam's completely oblivious because he's never read the book. So unless he did and that's what made him hate Stephen King so much. I guess we'll find out.
Well, Adam, I guarantee, saw me with this book under my arm at least three or four times throughout the course of our high school life. So I'm sure you saw me with this book in possession, right, Adam?
I'm distracted. If you're Dennis, I'm trying to figure out if that makes me Arnie. No. Or
I didn't go that far. No.
Am I Moochie? I absolutely remember you with this. And this is one of the few that I had seen back when I was a teenager. And I think you made me watch it. But I had actually seen this one before this viewing, amazingly enough. Which shouldn't be a surprise, because I do think this is one. When people talk about Stephen King, and then when people talk about John Carpenter, this is one of those titles that comes up.
I'm sure me and you watched it, because me and you would have like Carpenter marathons sometimes.
I found a way to slip that in to kind of, you know, freaking hook me into it. I don't know, kind of like a podcast.
Yeah, this was a movie I've seen a lot. I watched a lot as a teenager, obviously. Was pretty familiar with it. I still rewatched it for this podcast. But Matt, how many times had you seen this movie before we're doing this review?
Probably counted on one hand.
Really?
Because to me, there's other Carpenter movies I'd rather watch.
Yeah. Now, Adam, I'm assuming this is what, maybe your second time since you've seen it one other time?
Second watch. Yep.
Okay. And yeah, this movie, it comes out, it's not really a huge success.
No, but by Carpenter standards, it was a success.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So the making of this. So a year before this, Carpenter releases The Thing. Now, The Thing is looked at, and me and Matt reviewed this years ago, which might still see the light of day pretty soon. The Thing comes out, is derided by critics. It's released against a little movie called E.T. Does not make much at the box office. And at that time, there was a deal made for Carpenter to do another King adaptation, as I hinted at last week, Firestarter. But the failure of The Thing cost John Carpenter that job. Flash forward to Richard Kobritz, who we've talked about. He produced the Salem's Lot TV miniseries that we covered a few years ago. At that time, he was the Castle Rock, or probably Mike Flanagan of nowadays, where when King had a manuscript for a book, he would be the first person he sent it to, because he really liked what Kobritz did with Salem's Lot. And Kobritz got a copy of Firestarter, didn't really like that, but he did see this. John Carpenter was the first person he called. And in listening to the commentary for this, this is one of the only jobs. I mean, John Carpenter has done so many different things over his career, and you feel like there's a lot of passion behind a lot of what he does. Watch They Live, he definitely has things to say. Watch Big Trouble in Little China, he loved those old Hong Kong movies, wanted to pay tribute to those. Matt, this is one of the only movies, if not the only movie, where Carpenter said it was pretty much a job.
I would say this and Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Those are the two. You know, because this is also one of the only ones he's done, with maybe a handful of exceptions, I have to think about his whole career, that's not an original idea. He's adapting someone else's material. You know, and the same could be said for Cronenberg at this time. It's just ironic that this and The Dead Zone are within the same, like, ear space, and it's two directors who have gone on to be pillars of the genre, and both did Stephen King films that were far and away their biggest commercial successes, both financially and the directors getting their names out there. Because before this, all of Carpenter's films, you know, The Thing got mixed reviews, didn't do well, famously. Halloween spawned what it did. But a lot of his other, not that he had made a ton of movies at this point, because you had, what, The Fog? What else was before
Escape.
This? Escape from New York, yep, yeah. Which I love, but didn't do gangbusters. But yeah, this is definitely the biggest, like, closest to a paycheck thing he would ever make. Although, I will say, I think there's more inspiration in this movie than certainly some of his later work that he may have felt more passionate about, like Vampires, where, yeah, his name's on it, but I think that that's a really compromised movie, and I wish I liked it more than I did.
All right, Adam, we're finally getting to talk about John Carpenter. This is one of your favorite directors. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of John Carpenter. It's just everything that he brings to it, his influence, I mean, not even just the directing that he does, but the sense of atmosphere and mood, his scores. I mean, those resonate with me almost as much as his directing work, because I think that's such an integral part of most of his movies. And I think he's always been a director either ahead of his time, behind his time, or designed for, relegated almost to cult status. You know, to Matt's point, none of his movies really set the box office on fire, but he's lauded as just one of those Hollywood greats, and you can use that in quotes for that reason, you know. But I think everybody's got a John Carpenter story or film or character that they resonate with. So yeah, I'm always going to be down to put on Escape from New York or Big Trouble in Little China, you know, Halloween. It's just Carpenter resonates with me.
And everybody to that point has that one Carpenter movie that they like more than everyone else.
Yes.
You know, because everyone largely agrees on The Thing or Big Trouble in China, but when you look at like the back half of his career, usually there's one movie that everyone like you can point to and say, I like this more than the consensus. Except if you say Ghosts of Mars, I want to punch you in the face.
Prince of Darkness over here.
Which I think Ghosts of Mars is the only movie of his I've truly like detested.
I saw that in theaters and I damn near walked out. It was so bad. And I have not watched it since.
And to Adam's point, it's also the one where it's the worst score he's quote-unquote ever done. Now, granted, he wasn't exclusively behind it. He composed some of it and then handed it off to frickin' Anthrax.
Yeah. Yes.
One of those shitty, like, alternative bands from the early aughts.
Hey.
The Saliva Busy.
I was so excited when we got to this movie, though, because I'm getting to listen to a ton of Carpenter and preparing these credits, and that's always a good thing. I mean, there are so many what-ifs. Well, not so many. There are a few what-ifs when it comes to casting that we'll get to as we get into the movie, but let's just dive right in. We open up, we see the Columbia Pictures logo as a car starts, and then we see John Carpenter's Christine show up on the screen. And, you know, I gotta say, yes, this is a John Carpenter movie. His name's attached to this, but with a Stephen King property, Adam, it's kind of weird to see his name over the top of this title, isn't it?
Yeah, that kind of shocked me. As boring and rudimentary and just crappy as these credits are, yeah, I'm starting off that way. It struck me that it was John Carpenter's Christine, not Stephen King's Christine, yeah, directed by, or Stephen King and John Carpenter's. I can't imagine the fight that it created to get billing on it.
Well, I'm sure if King just handed Carpenter a bag of weed, that would have sold the deal. That man likes weed as much as he loves video games nowadays.
Video games and basketball.
Loves weed as much as King used to love coke.
Yeah. Matt, did that surprise you?
Yes and no. No, in the sense that that's the hallmark of even like John Carpenter, even when he did remakes, you know, John Carpenter's Village of the Damned, or you know you have a lot of cachet when even the font you use.
Yes.
Is associated with your direct, because you can find this font on Word. It's like Ambrose or something, but it's the John Carpenter font. So when you own text, that goes to show your stamp has a lot of power behind it.
All right, so no music yet over these titles, but once they finish, hello, George Thorogood. We're hearing Bat to the Bone, and this would have been new at the time this was out, and Carpenter on the commentary is very happy with the fact that he was the first person to use this. Thank you, John Carpenter, for introducing this to the masses, and now we have it over Chipmunk movies and all these other fucking terrible things that George Thorogood makes a fortune on nowadays.
Matt? Yeah, and it's freaking like, you know, this is before Terminator 2, yeah, which is probably the most famous example, but I think a lot of the songs that he uses perfectly illustrate Christine as a character. You know, there's a reason her name is top billed and the only name in the title.
Yes, and by the way, named after George A. Romero's wife.
Oh, that's cool. You know, it's also funny, like, I could have totally seen George Romero directing this movie.
Totally, yeah.
At one point.
Yeah, and with some things that happen in this, it's definitely a love letter to Romero, and we'll get to that when we get to it. Adam, what do you think of hearing George Thorogood here?
I had to remind myself that it's new, but this is, I don't think there's a more overused song. I mean, I'm fine with it, but it's such a, I'm like, okay. Thank God it's not redundant ad nauseum throughout this film.
Mm-hmm. But it's here at the beginning and it's here at the end. It's bookended very.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're seeing the car get assembled as a guy's hand gets slammed in the hood and another worker, he gets inside and is just crushed as bebop music plays. And the very next shot, he's leaning out of the car, burnt cigarette in hand. You know, I would have preferred that we start off with Arnie and Dennis getting the car because that's how the book starts off. Plus, let's get into it, Matt.
Yep.
The big omission in this movie, as opposed to the book, is the fact that the car is pretty much assembled evil. It comes off the assembly line evil.
I'm not bad. I'm just built that way.
In the book, the person who Arnie buys the car off of for $250, he dies almost immediately after, and his what do you say, Matt? His soul takes over the car? What?
No, it was this. I thought it was the soul of, like, yeah, it's possessed by the soul of the previous owner.
Yes. Yeah, Roland LeBay.
The same way that, like, Cujo is possessed by, like, a serial killer.
Uh-huh.
I like this better. I like that we get an explanation, but it's not overwrought. And I love how Christine, because she's a woman, the mechanics are basically doing the equivalent of lifting up her skirt. And that's why she slams the hood down on the guy's face. And she's vindictive because you should treat a woman with class. And he basically dumps the ashtray in her mouth and she retorts. So I think the car in this is characterized very well. It has a lot of personality for something that doesn't speak. And I was watching this going, is this what Transformers was ripping off with Bumblebee?
Oh my God. When we get to a choking scene later, I thought Michael Bay took that and ran with it.
Yeah, you're hitting one of my notes I'm going to get later, but yes.
Adam, how do you think about that? I mean, the three of us have gone off about the fact that King has this tendency to overexplain. There are times in the book where somebody smells dead flowers when they get inside the car because there's a corpse in the back rotting, which they can't really see. And as Christine adds up the victims are also in the back seat of the car. You know, their souls are pretty much. And they smell those corpses when they get in the car. That is an over-explanation. Here, the car is born evil. Adam, which one do you prefer?
I think the way that this is done cinematically is a much better choice. I think it holds a lot of restraint, and I think that's smart. I don't need everything explained. I got questions as I go through it. I'm like, hey, what's going on here? Who's is, you know, we'll discuss it later, but, you know, is Christine on her own? Does she have a driver? Is that, you know, and those questions don't have to be answered. And I kind of dig it almost as a ghost story by the end.
And yeah, this it's very much like The Fog in that aspect.
Yeah. But then also here at the beginning, I've noticed Christine is the only red car on this line. She's bloody already. All the other ones are pink and white. They're different tones. She's the only red vehicle. And so stands out, and she's got a thirst for blood already. I can't ignore the maximum overdrive thought of, you know, a killer car. I can't. But on the bright side, that never crosses my mind again after this opening scene.
Yeah. And in the book, there's also the thing the thing, no pun intended. So I don't like in the book, there's a part where Dennis gets in the car and he has like a psychic glimpse.
Yeah.
To what happened. I'm so glad that's not here among other omissions. I actually think this is of the adaptations that have changed a lot, more often than not in this instance, it's for the better. Because I like that this is, sorry for the pun, I like that it's more stripped down. I feel like this book was taken to a mechanic and had some body work done and cut out some of the fat. Because the book is freaking long.
The book is over 650 pages, yeah. In interviews with Bill Phillips, a screenwriter of this, and Carpenter, they both said the reason why they cut that storyline out is because American Werewolf in London had come out a year or two before this. And in that movie, you had a corpse talking to the main character and advising him. And they thought maybe it would look redundant if they did the same thing for this. Matt, do you agree with that? I mean, would that have looked... Well, would that have reminded you of American Werewolf in London?
To a degree, but I would have also thought you're not distinguishing enough from past King. You know, The Shining has psychics. The Dead Zone has psychics. It's a trope that even King himself has overused, and it's not going to be the last time we talk about it. So disseminating that from Christine, I think, was a wise decision.
So we move on to Rock Ridge, California. Now, in the book, again, going off of King making this a love letter to Romero, in the book it takes place in Pennsylvania. But here we're in Rock Ridge, California in September of 1978 as Dennis pulls into Arnie's house. Dennis, played by John Stockwell, and Arnie, played by Keith Gordon. Now, we've reviewed Keith Gordon on this podcast. We reviewed him last year when we did Jaws 2. Last week, we said Stand By Me is very rarely has there been a movie as well cast as that film was. I don't think there's been a movie that's been more miscast, with the exception of Arnie in this movie. I think John Stockwell's trying. He says in those supplementary materials that he was never a jock. He was never a football player. He tried really hard. He's gone on to direct Arnie. Keith Gordon has actually directed some really good TV. He directed a few episodes of The Killing. He directed a few episodes of House, Adam. He's
Dexter, Fargo, The Leftovers.
Yeah, yeah. He's done a lot of good directing. And John Stockwell has directed Into the Blue and Blue Crush and a terrible horror movie from 20 years ago called Turistas, which I saw in theaters. It is god awful. Oh, it was so bad. Of the whole cast here, and we'll get to the female lead here in a bit, but Keith Gordon's the one standout for me.
I'm distracted because for a movie about greasers, all I can think of is Grease, because they're at least 5 years too old to be playing high school kids at this point.
Oh, wait till we get to the bullies.
Even in Jaws 2, it was kind of pushing it with Keith Gordon. But at least he gives a good performance in this. I've also never liked John Stockwell in anything. I know his career isn't huge, but like you always forget he's in Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not particularly memorable, and you know Keith Gordon doesn't have a whole lot of credits as far as acting goes, but I think he leaves a bigger impression. I like that Arnie is not, given the home life and he's the outcast, it would have been very easy to just make him male Carrie, but I don't feel like they do.
You don't feel like they do? See, I think there's a few more hints of Carrie than
I even remember. There are, just because of the supernatural and the controlling parents, and I guess being corrupted by something. But this has an obsession dynamic to it that Carrie doesn't really have.
I agree that I don't necessarily get John Stockwell as a jock, especially, you know, star of the football team type of thing. And, I mean, that whole thing almost feels added just to get up runtime. But other than the age where 90210 would blush at the casting of these high school students, I kind of get that they're friends and hang out. Like I get their camaraderie. So as much as they may not come across as right for their roles, I believe them as buddies and friends, and I think the way they work on screen together works for me.
Now in the book, Arnie's parents have more of an overpowering presence in his life. Here, his mom's making sure Arnie has his yogurt before they leave. Matt, how do you feel about the way they handle Arnie's parents in this?
Well, it's toned down compared to the book. But at the same time, I feel like they're writing the parents like he's 10, not that he's 16. And maybe you could have done something about like parents who don't know when to back off, but the movie's not preoccupied with that kind of subtext.
Spend enough time on it that it bugs me. I mean, they're weird, overprotective parents. You know, maybe if there was a lost sibling or something like that. But I feel like he also never really fits in with anybody, so they're worried about him getting bullied. So,
oh, yeah, because if there's one thing that happens in Stephen King high school movies or even elementary schools, you get bullied to the level where there should be school shootings every week.
Arnie gets in Dennis's car, taped glasses and all, as they're talking about how Arnie and his mom were fighting out after their night of Scrabble.
Which, to be fair, that does happen a lot.
It does, yes. And how he uses the word fellatio when he was playing Scrabble. Dennis says, it's time Arnie gets laid, and asks, what does he care if he gets a little hair in his mouth? Oh, this is not as good as the interplay in Stand By Me. The dialogue here, oh boy. I just don't sense any chemistry between these two.
I do. Like, I feel like they're in different... I feel like they're in different places socially in school, but I think maybe they've just known each other long, you know, maybe since elementary school, and they've kind of gone different popularity routes in high school. But I believe that these guys have been friends for a long time. I think their chemistry works.
I'm not the biggest fan of Halloween, but I think the friend dynamic in that is better portrayed among the quote-unquote high school kids than it is in this. Mm-hmm.
Dennis has asked how his leg is feeling, as, oh, here's Kelly Preston, and she's asking Dennis how he is, and she says that she'll be seeing him out there in TTFN. I love how Arnie's like interjecting himself, and the guy responds, having problems with your locker? Then we get the introduction to Alexandra Paul, and my God, exchange Alexandra Paul and Kelly Preston, and I think you have a good movie, or at least a good female lead. But God, her delivery in this, I can't stand Alexandra Paul in this. It's fitting that she would go on to do Baywatch and not much else acting-wise after this. She is the weak link of this cast. I fucking hate her.
Dang, how do you really feel? So, I watched Baywatch quite a bit because I was on planet Earth when it existed. And Alexandra Paul was the character I actually liked most on that show. I don't give a damn about Pam Anderson, but I liked Alexandra Paul. Other than the fact that she looks like she's in her late 20s walking through high school, she looks at least 10 years too old for this.
Well, she was 21.
Okay. She looks 26, and that's being generous. But I don't know. I don't think Kelly Preston has the chops to do this lead. It's funny that she would go on, you know, She married her own greaser.
Yeah.
But I think she's fine. I think she carries this more than a lot of people could.
Ugh, she's got the same fucking delivery. I can't stand it.
Well, she delivers her lines like she's talking to a child.
Mm-hmm.
When you're if you're a camp counselor, this is how you talk to your campers. And I find it annoying, but also like this is the thing of bland love interest, which several, like Carrie has that to a degree as well with her quote-unquote boyfriend, who I've never found interesting in any of the four versions that we watched. Soon to be a fifth one, by the way, everybody, because they can't leave that girl buried. They keep... But yeah, I think you have Kelly Preston in this movie, who wasn't the greatest actress in the world, but certainly was a big improvement. And fuck Blue Lagoon, because we could have had Brooke Shields in this.
Yes, that was going to be my next note, is Brooke Shields was in the running for this role. And yeah, Blue Lagoon is what pretty much disqualified her from taking it. I would have preferred to see her here, honestly.
And Columbia wanted Scott Baio for Arnie.
Yep, Columbia.
Yeah, no way I'd believe him as the outcast.
The other one that they were going to get, I believe, for John Stockwell's character of Dennis. You hear about this one, Matt?
Yeah, Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon, which I definitely could have seen. And he was attached for a while, and then Footloose came around, and he was like, you know what, I'll take this lead as opposed to this movie.
I could absolutely see that.
Yes. I like all those casting choices a hell of a lot better than what we got. Let's put it that way. So Dennis opens Arnie's locker as he says, see you at lunch. And then Dennis finds out that Arnie is still in the shop, and we see that Buddy Repperton, who must have been hanging out with Nick from Teen Wolf, because Jesus Christ, you talk about somebody too old for school.
Yeah, clearly this guy was held back, held back more time than drunk fans on the sidelines.
My God. Adam, you always complain about this 90210 syndrome. I mean, there's no real more obvious one than this, right?
This guy's too old for graduate school, less high school. Holy hell.
John, yeah, this Parker is 90210. Oh, what the hell is this?
Pull this guy out of a bar to come to high school?
Buddy stabs the bag with yogurt in it. And then Dennis tells Buddy to put down the knife as Arnie is shoved down by Stu Charno, Matt, who we've also reviewed before when we did Friday the 13th years ago.
Yeah, even, I mean, you got a lot of horror alumni in this.
Not only that, but we have a Ghostbusters alumni, because we have the guy who Peter Venkman will be fucking with in the next year in Ghostbusters here as well.
Yep.
So the principal is told about Buddy's knife, and Arnie reinforces the story as Buddy gives it up and is told to go to the office. Buddy then threatens Dennis and Arnie as he leaves.
See, I don't get some of this, though, because unless they got previous history, this is day one of school.
Yeah.
This is a lot to be going on for your first day of, I don't know, I'm assuming senior year, maybe it's junior year. It just seems a little crazy that this is how the year starts.
We cut to Arnie and Dennis talking about their not-so-bad first day. They talk about how Buddy is kicked out as Arnie makes Dennis stop the car because he wants to look at her, quote-unquote. And that's when we see Christine in her not-so-great glory. Arnie says she can be fixed up, and Dennis says it probably has 193,000 miles on it. And then here comes George LeBay to say that she'll start with keys. I like the way that Keith Gordon's playing this. Adam, it's love at first sight, right?
It is, and I want to say I like the way that this is shot, directed, and acted, because we got an introduction to Kelly Preston's Roseanne, we got Alexander Paul Lee, we've seen some other people, so they're driving down, ooh, let me look at her. You know, you think they're going to be craning, and which one of the two girls are they looking at? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the question. Neither one, it's Christine, and I think that's pretty fucking great. That got me. I was like, okay, smart piece of writing, directing. I like it. And it does enforce that fact that Christine's her own character, which, duh, but she's that woman on the side that, you know, she's a little evil, but you got to check her out.
Yeah, she's a succubus in this.
Mm-hmm. Toxic relationship, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, Adam, you bring something up. I was going to bring it up later, but I want to talk about it now. One thing I've never really noticed in all the times I'd seen this movie up until this viewing is how well it's directed. John Carpenter does a hell of a job with this movie. There are scenes with a Panaglide camera where he's going around corners, and that's how Christine is revealed at certain parts. There are times when we have over-the-shoulder shots, and he's panning up to another person. And the blocking in this is also really well done. The lighting is really well done. Matt, is this one of Carpenter's better directing jobs?
Well, that's a high bar, because he's got so many, especially early on. But I will say, everything that makes him great is stamped in here. He's always had a keen eye for like shot structure and the way he's used different lenses for his movies. And this was also the first time he worked with the editor on this, would edit Starman.
Oh yeah.
After this, she did a couple of the Planet of the Apes films that we talked about back in the day. So I like that some of his, even though he doesn't have a lot of his regular collaborators on here, there are still all of his like directing touches that are here.
Adam, as the Carpenter fan, you must have noticed how good the directing is here, right?
While I don't think it's great, because I do think there's other ones that are great, I think it's very good. And I think other directors would have just screwed it up badly. And I think that's the big change. I think he's doing good to very good. And I don't think he ever has parts where he fucks it up. And I easily could see this, especially the subject matter and the time that this was made. Other directors would have just screwed the pooch on this.
And specific things, too. Like I said, the way he shoots the car, there are times when he pans around and you see the grill, like, right in your face, right? Well, King in the book describes it as the grill looking like teeth. We have specific shots of the tires peeling out. King in the book describes the tires, when they peel out, they sound like a woman screaming. These are things that he really keys on. I was really impressed in watching it this, because I did not remember it as this. I remember this being exactly what Carpenter says it was, a paycheck job. But I do feel like he had something to prove here. And he does it well. And the next year, he would get some of his biggest acclaim when he does Starman.
One of your favorites.
Yeah, I love that. Absolutely love
that. That is one of his best movies, I will say.
It's so much heart in that thing. And do you guys recognize George LaBey, Robert's Blossom here?
Yeah, all I see is the homeless guy from Home Alone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With the back brace, which, by the way, is from the book. Although, in the book, it's the actual owner who sells Arnie the car. Here is the owner's brother. And I want to get into different specifics about that when we get further into the plot. But that is a change that I just don't understand.
I do, based on the way this movie started and based on the change of it coming off the line that way. Because I read into the changes for once. I was into this movie enough that I wanted to see what the difference is. And I think it makes sense for this telling of the story.
Arnie says he just got his license. And George says her name is Christine. He says that the smell of a brand new car is about the best smell in the world. Well, except for pussy.
It's not a new car.
We hear that Roland died a few weeks ago, and he'll sell the car to Arnie for $250. Dennis is trying to talk him out of it, and Arnie says the fact that she's 20 years old makes her an official antique.
Fuck you. George, you know, that's technically true based on how they date things, but looking at my toys and comics and games, and fuck you, Arnie.
George tells Dennis that he doesn't know as much as he thinks he does before calling him shitter. So we move on. We see Arnie with his parents, and his parents just hate the fact that he bought that car. And he says that he bought it, and that's it. And Arnie's mom asks Dennis how he could let this happen, as Arnie says he's getting the fuck out of here. She says he's not keeping any car at this house, as he yells fine and leave. We then cut to Darnell's. By the way, I love the fact that Christine's, her horn doesn't work, so he has to get out and open this thing himself. And Darnell, the owner, just ransacks him for the exhaust and tells Dennis that if he sold that to him, he should be ashamed of himself. Now, Darnell's played by Robert Prosky. You know, I just rewatched Thief just a couple months ago. He is terrifying in that movie. And 10 years after this, he would be giving the magic ticket to Austin O'Brien in Last Action Hero. Here, he's just kind of an asshole, right, Matt?
You're skipping over also, he's the Grandpa Munster in Gremlins 2.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Gremlins 2. Yeah.
Yeah, and this, he's in a lot of Michael Mann's early films.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't he just get it from either the garage owner or George LaBey? It's weird that he has both. He buys the car and then he brings it to someone else's shop, which every time I hear the shop, I freaking think of Firestarter.
Of course.
I think it fits for what they got going on. Kind of like what the people here in this garage and how they're acting. I like he's given a little more to do later and brings him in, but I dig it. It fills out this world kind of well. This movie's not long, and they populate it with just enough to keep it going without making anybody seem superfluous.
Now, to get back to the streamlining that Carpenter did with this, in the book, this character, he's running a cigarette smuggling line. So he tells Arnie, you can keep that car in here if you do these errands for me. And the fact that he's out doing those errands, and those errands are done like in Massachusetts, they're done all over the place. The fact that he's out doing those makes it an alibi when Christine starts killing later on. So it's obvious that Arnie is not behind the wheel because he's not there. He's out running errands for Darnell. Here, they have streamlined it, and I think the reason they did that is to keep the suspense of whether Arnie's behind the wheel later on when we do the kills.
And you hit something that to me is important later on, because first time or two, I'm frustrated, and then I understand that's part of what's going on. And yeah, I like that. I think the garage gets a little simplified, though. The way that Christine's put back together, we don't understand it. And look, that could be part of the we're not meant to know. Not everything adds up with the parts she gets in that. But I like it. And Look, my dad used to take me to pulling pits at places, and man, I remember walking through frickin' salvage yards looking for a specific alternator for a certain car and that kind of shit. So it brought me back to that, which is funny, I gotta say. And I know it's, you know, it gets a little sentimental on that sometime, but I'm watching this and my dad randomly called me up and said, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Watching Christine." He's like, "Wait, the Stephen King movie?" I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "The old one." Yeah. He goes, "Man, I watched that." And he remembers, he goes, "That movie was such a big hit, though. We all talked about that movie." So it was kind of sweet to have that moment.
Sweet. So Darnell drops a line to Dennis that he knew a guy who had a car like that, and the guy ended up killing himself in it. He then says that he can keep the car there if it doesn't smoke, and Arnie points out a few guys who are smoking. He tells Arnie to shut his pie hole and not to screw up, because no matter how much money he pays up front, he'll throw him the hell out of there. Dennis is asking Arnie if he's going to be okay, and then right away he tells Dennis he better find another charity other than him and Christine, and he gravitates to her because for the first time in his life, he has found something uglier than him. And Arnie's dad is all over him as he goes up to the house. We cut to Arnie working on the car, and Darnell is shocked at how much he's done in 3 weeks. He says he has good hands, but bad taste in cars, and he adds that you can't polish a turd. Prosky gets a lot of the great lines in this.
He does.
Darnell then approaches Arnie, and you can tell that he has gained some respect with what he's done with this car, even though he says to not think that he's got the gold key to the crapper. He also says that while he doesn't have money falling out of his asshole, they can make a deal and that he can keep the car here if Arnie does chores for him, and he'll even throw a few bucks in and let him raid his junk pile. Arnie is already starting to change, the glasses are gone, and of course his hair is slicked back, greaser style, so...
Yeah, and right away I'm going, oh no.
Yeah, so you guys are all over King about his greasers. Here, Christine turns Arnie into a greaser.
Okay, I understand they throw dates up on screen and they expect me to remember it. This shit happens quick.
Yeah.
Now, look, we've all slept with somebody and maybe we started acting a little bit different immediately. I get it. But, yeah, this shit's a little too fast for me. And I don't understand anything that's, we see a little bit of it because the day he brings Christine home to his parents, he's suddenly argumentative. He's suddenly changing. But the change up to Arnie is really quick. I mean, Anakin Skywalker would say, damn, that's a quick change.
I was just going to say that. But yeah, it's also the whole thing, like, that girl, you're too good for that girl. Bring the girl home for dinner. And look, we all know that friends, once you get in a relationship, you either stop seeing them entirely or happens. And that's kind of what's happening here. It didn't take long for her to some influence. I guess he told her, your future girlfriend's going to die in childbirth, and I have the midichlorian count to save her.
And I will just be hiding underneath my table after that last soliloquy. We cut to Dennis and his friends, and they make a bet that Dennis can't get Lee's number, and they're admiring how she's holding the pencil to her mouth. Dennis walks up, and Carpenter films it very slowly, and he's asking her what she's reading. Dennis asks her out dancing, and she turns him down, saying that she has a date. We then hear the librarian or teacher tell Dennis to go back to his seat, as Kelly Preston just kind of looks over with sad eyes. And this is pretty much the last time we see her this entire film. She has two scenes. We cut to Dennis pulling up to Arnie's house, and his parents are once again yelling at Arnie about the car. Arnie's not happy that Dennis is there, and Arnie says that he has to do an errand for Darnell. Dennis tells Arnie's mom that he hardly sees Arnie anymore. And she says Arnie has changed since he got the car, and that when they signed the papers, they heard that the last guy who owned it died of carbon monoxide poisoning. We see Dennis head to LeBay's house, saying that he knows his brother died in Christine, and LeBay says that his brother died because he wanted to. He then says that no shitter ever came between his brother and Christine, and that Rita, his wife, killed herself in the car. Okay, so this use of the word shitter. So here is a big problem I have with the plot change they do with this movie as opposed to the book. In the book, the reason why Arnie is starting to say shitter and starts taking on this personality is because he's being possessed by Roland. Here, it doesn't make any sense that he's saying shitter and changing because what's possessing him? Okay, he's whipped to this fucking woman. I get it, but come on, Matt. That's really pushing it, isn't it?
To an extent, but it works for me because he's trying to imprint himself based on the time that Christine would have been popular, so he's trying to emulate that. But I also think that's an instinctive I think it's a lose-lose situation, because if you included that where he's like possessed by the spirit, I'm like, okay, then instead of calling a mechanic, you call an exorcist.
Yeah.
I didn't need to see the breaker cyst.
I I think the movie does it better. But it wasn't until just now I realized that we're literally discussing Roland again, and we just had to deal with the Roland.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. And we got greasers, we got dead previous owners in the book and possession. Like, it's funny how King laps around more than your local YMCA pool.
I just now got that breaker cyst comment you made. it
took a while.
Yeah, that's a slow burn.
I think that's as long as it took Stephen King to write Maximum Overdrive.
Arnie says, even though they tried getting rid of the car, it came back 3 weeks later.
Sometimes they come back.
Yeah. We then see Dennis sneak into Darnell's and take a look at the car. He looks inside and sees the speedometer going backwards. And this was kind of the impetus for King to write this book, is when he was in a car, he was wondering, what would it be like if the speedometer went backwards instead of forwards, meaning it was going backwards.
It's called you take it to the mechanic.
What would that mean? Would it be going back through time or whatever? Like, and he just kind of took that and eventually turned into a story about possession, but that's where it came from.
I'm sorry. That's one of the stupidest impetuses for the genesis of a book I've ever heard. Like, that's where your mind goes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, granted, it was probably filled with other
stuff. I was going to say, don't forget how many drugs he was on around this time.
What cocaine, officer? Allegedly.
Dennis tries getting in, and what does Christine do? She plays a song, "You Can Keep On Knocking, But You Can't Come In," which I actually kind of laughed at.
Okay, not only do I literally laughed out loud, I had no remembrance that this car is Bumblebee.
Yep.
Like, it, I could not believe that this, I mean, Jesus, it's done well, but I'm just, George Lucas gonna sue somebody. Wow.
George Lucas.
It's a line from a different movie. Oh, never mind.
Oh, okay. I didn't get that.
Because it's the second time we've had a joke go over his head.
Yeah.
Which is normally very odd because he's so tall in real life.
It's been a long week. Leave me alone. You know, and this green light coming from the radio, I mean, all that is very loyal to the book. That is straight from the book.
Well, I was thinking of Carpenter, the fog. When you see the blue tint come in, it's almost like the forbearing warning of what's to come. Which is the remake from 2005, which was one of the worst things you will ever see.
I saw that in theaters. It was so...
Yeah, because it had Tom Welling in it.
Yes, that's the reason. Exactly. We cut to Dennis's high school football game as Dennis sees Arnie pull up with Lee and Christine. And even Buddy sees this, and his buddies tell him that they know where he keeps it. As Dennis goes for a pass, he sees Arnie and Lee making out, and he gets completely laid out, which Buddy cheers. I laugh every time he does that. Such an asshole thing to do. But you know what? Here's what I'll say about this. This is the first time that we really hear Carpenter's score kick in. Adam, as the huge fan of the man, how do you feel about his score in Christine?
I was waiting for it to be a bigger part of the movie because his scores normally are kind of a character on their own. And it's not until it is. It's amazingly well restrained, being that you kind of don't have to and you're known for his scores picking up. When it kicks in, I freaking love it. I'm just surprised they don't overdo it like they normally do.
Yeah, and the movie doesn't immediately start with the synthesizer type of score. They make you wait for it.
We then see Dennis being taken out on a stretcher, and Carpenter does a real good job. Again, I'm going to keep complimenting him here, but he's always ending scenes with shots of the car. That was a nice choice that I've never really noticed until I watched it.
Yeah, it's almost like the car is controlling the, you know, it's almost like he's the defensive coordinator, which never happened because the NFL wouldn't let a woman be a DC.
Would that make Christine Rossini? Arnie goes to visit Dennis at the hospital and gives him a book of 5,000 dirty limericks. He says the team hasn't won a game since he got hurt, and Dennis says that he won't be playing football anymore, and one more centimeter, he would have been paralyzed. And this was a bigger scene. The movie has about 20 deleted scenes. Swear to Christ, 20 deleted scenes. A lot of it is more of the stuff in the hospital. There's stuff with Arnie and Lee walking to the garage later. But I think, Adam, I think you hit it. I think this movie is just long enough, and any more of these scenes would have probably been bad.
Yeah, I don't need it any longer than it is. It's less is more, and this movie is edited quite well to get to that point.
Yeah, I'm sure that they would have been good scenes, but it would have just felt like you're extending the runtime.
Which, and this movie already had to have the cursing because they were scared to death of getting a PG rating.
Well, I was going to
say they thought was going to tank it.
Yeah, I was going to get there. Hold off on that. I have thoughts about that when we get to the deaths. So Arnie brags about getting Lee, saying that she just lusts after his body, and Dennis asks how Arnie was able to fix up the car like he did. He says with good old-fashioned hard work. He then says that his parents don't want him growing up, as then they'd have to face getting old, and part of being a parent is trying to kill your kids. Arnie's starting to get whipped here, isn't he, Adam?
Yeah, a little bit.
We cut to a drive-in theater as Carpenter is again shooting the car in very slow panning style. We see Arnie and Lee making out, and Carpenter even does a long shot of the radio. Lee then gets out saying that she's sorry, and as Arnie approaches her, she says that she can't in that car as it freaks her out because he cares more about the car than her.
You know, if these people would just be nice to Christine, none of this would have happened.
Well, maybe Christine's just lashing out at the acting that Alexander Paul's doing here because Jesus Christ. He takes her back inside because it's raining, and she instigates by hitting the seat, saying, "What, you don't like me hitting your girl?" Arnie says, "No one likes his car these days." Arnie then goes to attend to the car's wipers as Lee grabs a burger. And by the way, one thing I noticed in rereading that book, guys, it makes you really hungry for terrible food. They go to burgers, they get chicken, there are burritos, like so much fucking fast food explained in that book. Here we're seeing a burger, and...
Which is ironic, though, because there's no drive-thrus in the...
Yes! So Lee's eating this burger, she starts choking when the lights turn on, and Arnie can't get in to help her.
Been there, I'm talking about choking out a cheeseburger.
She is then grabbed by a stranger who saves her by doing the Heimlich maneuver. And this was a bigger scene in that book. This character is actually, he kind of plays a bigger part than he does here. Here he's just kind of saving her, and he has more of a talking scene than that. But Adam, Christine's starting to get jealous, isn't she?
She is, and I think this is a pretty cool kill scene, though. All right, if you're at the drive-in and it is pouring rain, you are not going to leave your windows cracked open to get that radio in, even if you have to, because that leather's getting wet. And I, for the first time in history, have leather in a car. God damn you if you're getting my leather wet. I don't know where the light's coming from inside the car when this happens. Like, the logistics make no sense, and I don't care. It looks pretty freaking great.
They did some crazy things with lighting in this. Like, at one point when the headlights turn on behind the villains later, like, they have airplane landing lights to overpower the camera. They did some really interesting tricks with these lights, and I agree with you. I think it works really well.
Yeah, the only thing that's unrealistic is that this is a time where the Heimlich maneuver was apparently universally known.
Right.
The most unrealistic thing in this movie.
As opposed to a sentient car? Really?
Back in the 70s, yeah.
Okay, we cut.
Because with LSD, you believe your car was talking to you.
We cut to Arnie dropping Lee off as she tells Arnie to get rid of that car, and then he tells her to not blame her choking on Christine. She points out that the radio plays only old songs and the car stalls when they're making out. Arnie says that he thinks she's just sexually frustrated.
Lee's, I was thinking of freaking, it's that scene in At Pupil.
Yeah, good call. Very good call. Lee says that she's not sure if Arnie should call her tomorrow as she enters her house. Arnie gets in the car and it stalls. He tells her to come on and then assures her that everything is the same, and this is when it actually starts.
I thought this was the prequel to Crash.
Right.
And we were going to get him fucking the car.
Him fucking the car. A movie me and Adam saw in theaters.
Yeah, a lot of people did. And that, I'm sure that movie had more walkouts than the last Met game.
Fuck you.
Hey, misery loves company.
We see Arnie pull Christine into Darnell's, and he's followed by Buddy and his gang. They destroy Christine, and yes, in the book, it's said that one of them did take a dump on the dashboard. Although in the book, it's at an airport parking lot, because even Darnell's like, no, you can't park that here.
Because back then, you could just park at an airport, and nobody would complain.
I like this change. I like that they're stabbing the seats. We have hammering of the body. They're destroying the radio.
Yeah, this is like the equivalent of a rape scene.
And you know what? The track accompanying this is called The Rape Scene. So yeah, that is very much what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, it feels pornographic or like a snuff film. It's very, very well done.
Or a smuffler film.
Jesus fucking Christ. Save him for when we do the Cars retrospective. We cut to Arnie and Lee as Arnie says that he just wants to get his wallet out of Christine. Why would you leave that wallet in your car?
Yeah, why did he leave it in the glove compartment?
Yeah, they enter the garage, and Carpenter is smart to just keep the camera on Arnie as it's his reaction that matters, not what happened to the car.
Love that choice. Yeah. Love that choice.
Me too. He stops mid-sentence, and the camera just pans to a complete completely eviscerated Christine. And when Lee tries comforting him, he just yells at her to not touch him. And Arnie's always in red here. And it was his choice. Like, they had rehearsed this scene a lot. Keith Gordon had always done this very low-key. And he completely surprised Alexandra Paul when he just exploded at her like this. And her reaction here is completely genuine. So nice choice by Keith Gordon there. But this, Adam, I mean, this is like seeing your girl hurt, right?
It is. It gets a little weird here in a moment. But yeah, this is, you got two different girls you're seeing. You're taking one girl to meet the other girl and realize she got beat up by your bullet. Yeah.
Getting a lot of psychoanalysis into our personal lives on the show.
All right, I'll move on. We see Arnie at the dinner table as his mom apologizes for what happened to the car. Arnie says it's their fault for not letting him park his car in the driveway.
He's not wrong.
He's not. Arnie is not interested in talking rationalization, and his dad even says that they've decided to help him buy a new car. He says, fuck you, and walks to the door as his dad approaches him, and Arnie grabs his dad and holds him to the wall and says, take your mitts off me, motherfucker.
Oh, this is like in those, like, drug PSAs where the kids become rebellious and, like, hit back. That's all I could think of watching this. I was half expecting we were going to get Michael Jordan to come up and say, like, stop, get help. Which is ironic coming from him.
I like this, though. I like that we're seeing Arnie just uninhibited. You know, in the book, again, those parents are so overpowering. Here, he's overpowering the parents, and I think it works to the movie's advantage.
The only issue that is with this that I have is that it just happens. We don't see Arnie's descent. Arnie just changes. And that's the only kind of critique that I have with it.
We cut to Arnie with Christine talking to her and saying that they can't hurt them now if they are together. He stands back and says, show me. And this may be my favorite Carpenter theme in the entire movie. Is this scene? Is this part right here? I mean, come on, Adam, this is the sex scene, right?
Oh, yeah. This is, take your dress off.
Yeah.
But this is also when I'm like, okay, he's fully complicit. Does it make sense? Nope, not really.
Is he possessed? Way they usually don't make sense.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Is he possessed? Is he just down that road? Is he imagining part of it? It's not all clear, but this theme is great. When that key gets hit for that note, and you basically see American Werewolf in London happen here with Christine, it's a pretty cool scene.
Don't forget, no digital effects at this time. So they actually had to destroy these cars and they had to fix them up. And they had about 20 of these cars made up for this movie. Some with engines, some without, obviously. You know, everything had a different implication. But here what they did was, it's very interesting to hear Carpenter talk about this on the commentary. This is rubber and they had it hooked to hydraulics and they just filmed it in reverse as it deflates. Mm-hmm. Just really interesting stuff that with sound and everything, back in the 80s, this was really good visual effects filmmaking. And I don't know, Adam, I know you agree with this. I kind of miss this kind of filmmaking.
Oh yeah, no, I do. And look, I can tell when they're doing it with something life-sized. I can tell that some of these are models that they're doing on some of the shots, but the way that it's shot and lit and edited together, pretty damn cool scene. I miss practical work like this.
Well, because you had to be a lot more creative and resourceful with how you shot scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now it's a lot. You almost don't even have to put thought into it because you can come up with anything. Oh, it's one of the coolest scenes in the movie of the car, like, putting herself back together. You know, it's mm-hmm. like watching Wolverine heal.
Yeah, I used to watch the scene a lot, like, over and over as a teenager when I had this taped off cable.
Especially because you instinctively know, oh, they destroyed these cars and then they literally yep. had to reassemble footage along with the cars themselves.
It also has to be said, too, that this is the first time that we actually see her be kind of supernatural.
And this is like the full confirmation she's sentient.
Yep. We cut to Moochie being dropped off, and as he's walking, he spots Christine in the distance. He says, no hard feelings, and the car attacks. I like this. I like the image Carpenter shoots of Moochie running to the camera as Christine's behind him. And I like that Carpenter just kind of keeps the windows dark to keep it ominous. But you can't help but think, dude, go over the fucking hood. Like, what are you doing just going in this alley and just getting smashed?
Yeah, but I like the way this is shot. You know, there hasn't been action really in this till this point. And you forget the kind of movie this is. We got some good escalation here. And this thing is paced nicely to get to this point. And once we get here, yeah, you know, it's retribution time.
Bullies yeah, I like that the guy who made Halloween is making her a slasher villain now.
Mm-hmm. This image of her just smashing through the fence and then mashing through that little alley just to crush Moochie, always a sight. But here's what I'll say, boys. And this goes back to, Adam, what you were talking about with the rating. That book is extremely violent. There is a lot of blood and guts in that book. Now, would I want it to be as violent as that? No. But here's what I came up with in watching it this time. I think Carpenter was kind of feeling the backlash of what happened with The Thing the year before. I think he was trying to go back to his Halloween roots here. There's not that much blood here, if any. Matt, do you find Carpenter kind of being restrained when it comes to the violence here?
Yeah, I think that was a big thought in his mind of The Thing. One of the things that the detractor said about it was nothing but a big gore fest. And I could see how you don't want to lean into that and make it think that that's the only trick you have. But at the same time, so much of this movie feels like overly sanitized. And then they do the thing of modern PG-13 movies having to put in the one F-bomb to make themselves feel edgier because they couldn't get a full R. And I find that just to be an annoyance with filmmaking in general.
It's funny, for a little bit, Bill Phillips talks about this in The Making of Doc. They were the most profane movie ever at a point. And then Scarface came out like a couple weeks later and just took that mantle right away from that. Pacino himself said more fucking dirty words than this movie utters. Adam, how'd you feel about the violence or lack thereof in this film?
I think the restraint makes this movie work that much better. I don't need this to be, I spit on your grave. You know, I think doing this more like Halloween is part of what makes this still stand the test of time.
And I think also if there was a lot more violence, it would have been harder to take it as seriously. Yeah. As ridiculous as that says to be about a movie with a talking car, but like you think about how over the top like Maximum Overdrive gets with some of the kills in that. Granted, this was before that, but at the same time, it would have been a similar thing of you'd instinctually be almost laughing at the thought of a car killing people, let alone decapitating people or running them over, and you see like the big blood squibs.
In the book, she runs Moochie over and then just goes over and over him, like over and over, to make sure that he's dead.
Yeah, she keeps backing up and hitting him again.
Yep. We cut to Dennis waking up with a football game on, so it must be Thanksgiving. Arnie's here and he's pouring a beer.
Well, if the Lions are on, it's definitely Thanksgiving. That's how you tell. Look, is it Dallas or Detroit? It's one of those two teams. It's Thanksgiving.
Arnie pours a beer and talks about what happened to Moochie, saying it almost makes you feel sorry for the little bastard.
How bad shape is Dennis in that weeks later he's still in a hospital?
Yeah, like he didn't have a Joe Theismann level of injury on the football field.
Well, it could have been a concussion. He could have
been weeks.
You don't know.
So, yeah, like he should be in a full body cast if he's going to be there this long, especially with back in the 70s where hospital bills a day was crazy enough, let alone weeks.
Arnie says Christina's perfecto now, and even though Dennis says he heard she was totaled and it was Buddy Repperton who did it, Arnie says he promises Buddy won't do it again. We see Arnie greeted by a criminally underused Harry Dean Stanton. We haven't talked about him all podcast. Why? Because he's another one who has like three scenes in this entire movie. And by the way, he's another one who gets killed in the book. Here he's playing Junkins and he's asking how Arnie's car is in perfect order given how totaled it was. Adam, how'd you feel about seeing Harry Dean Stanton here?
It's about time, freaking an hour into this movie, that he shows up, being that he's in the opening credits. Yes. I was excited because I had forgotten, didn't realize he was in this. And then I forgot that he got a credit until he shows up. And I'm like, that's right. It's about time. You know what? Good times. He's a good presence to have here. He comes in and it's somebody I recognize from so many different things. So this is a happy moment.
Well, he comes in way too late to introduce this type of like detective element, which if you were going to pull this card, which it would have made sense because how do you like brush these under the rug, these murders, but it comes in so late that it feels like there's more to the movie, and then there's really not. Like, he doesn't really get a full resolution. And this reminds me of a lot of, like, it feels like almost something that they were forced to include. Like, I was thinking of movies like Brain Scan with the Frank Langella detective, where I get why you're here, because you have to have someone, like, doing the legwork to try to piece this together, but this should have happened a lot earlier.
Arnie tries passing off the paint not matching, and he says it's a hell of a job. He then stands in front of the car and he says that they don't make this shade of red anymore. Junkins offers Arnie a cigarette and talks about how shaken up Lee was, about how trash the car was, and Arnie didn't report how total Christine was, and he even asks him about how Moochie was cut in half and that his girlfriend is more convincing than he is, and Arnie tells Junkins to stay off his back. I like this back and forth. I like how Gordon's playing off of Stanton, but as you guys have mentioned, there's just not enough of it to really matter, though this is word for word from the book.
Yeah, this is one of the more direct translations as far as like dialogue in a movie that is not beholden to the book.
And again, Carpenter's ending the scene on the car as Arnie is just wiping it clean. We cut to Arnie calling Lee, saying that he loves her and that he thinks they deserve one more try. And when she's nonchalant about her response, he says, "Fuck you, bitch," and hangs up.
Well, now he's turning into that, like, overbearing voice. overbearing boyfriend. Like, you know, this could be Mark Wahlberg. And what was that movie? Fear?
Fear. Yeah.
Fear.
It was also,
out of the fucking house.
This was also me and Adam in high school.
No.
We cut to Buddy and his friends in a gas station as they grab some liquor and go to pick up their other friend. As they're leaving,
yeah, except they didn't get carded because these guys are well past the point of being able to buy alcohol and nobody thinks twice about it.
There was a panel with Buddy from Australia taken just a couple years ago. And my God, he looks to be about 80 years old, which he probably is.
Probably is.
Yeah, did they interview him in a nursing home?
As they're leaving, they see Christine behind them with her brights on. They flip her off, and the chase is on as she completely takes out Buddy's car. Some weird edits here, though, as in one shot, we're seeing Christine head right towards the guy from Ghostbusters, and the very next shot is of her hitting the car. So,
well, it's a woman driver, so...
You said it this time, not me.
We got to keep exchanging it so that we all get the equal backlash. Not one person alone should take all the bullets.
Despite that, I do really like the scene. I love the gas station blowing up. It's a great image. And
oh, it's the freaking tanker blowing up in the first Terminator.
Yeah, I thought of Terminator 2 while watching this. And when I say Terminator
you
2,
mean
I mean
Terminator
the first one. Yeah.
The Terminator 2 joke. That popped me. This is so good. And I love that I don't know if Arnie's in the car or not.
Yeah.
You never know because the windows are blacked out. And I think, in retrospect, I think that's great. It frustrated me until I got to the end of the movie and then realized it didn't matter. I think it's a really good choice. And then that iconic shot of Christine on fire. I've seen it so many times, but I haven't watched it in the context of this movie since I was probably 15, 16. And that was an image I was like, ugh, this is going to be just, you see things in clips and you're just, it's going to be overblown. Nah, it works so well in this. And I love watching Buddy get run down. And it's just, no.
I like it, but he can get out of the way, right? He's running in the road. Like,
this is one of those movies where people can only run in a straight line. It's
so
Prometheus problem.
This is the Prometheus.
Boy, you guys are in complete fucking in sync with this. But it just feels anticlimactic because of that.
No,
but
I don't think she listened to that on her speakers.
A little too early.
But that's
not just because it's got to be May.
Oh, God. But that shot of her in pursuit and on fire is just glorious. I would love it in a painting. Just amazing.
That should be the cover of the reprint.
Yes. Oh, my God. So amazing. Mm-hmm. But again, just the fact that he's just running in the street right on the yellow lines. Like, dude.
So, like, if he ran in front of a crowded street and she hit a red light, would she have actually stopped or just run right through it?
Right. We cut to Darnell leaving the garage, but Christine makes her way in, and when Darnell takes a shotgun and sits in the seat to kind of investigate why she's on fire or in smoke, he also gets killed as the seat crushes him against the dashboard. Another just stupid death. The book is...
It's right out of Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, no shit, right? Like, the book is crazy. Like, the way Darnell dies in the book, he's busted for tax evasion, right? So, he's in his house. But here comes Christine through the house, and she chases him up the stairs and just runs him over. Crazy scene to read.
Yeah, it's literally... And I was going to laugh when I say this. It's the episode in South Park with the old people driving, and they hide in the decrepit house, and the car drives up the stairs.
Adam, how'd you feel about Darnell's death here?
I was okay with it, but I also, you know, I don't have the book reference for it. Was it a little goofy? Maybe. And Darnell also didn't deserve it, but to finish off the scene, I was wondering how it was going to happen. I'm good with it.
There's also a weird subplot where he has ties to the mob, too. It's very... Darnell's just much different in that book.
Yeah, like he's indebted basically to the guy from Thinner.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, come on, Matt. This is anticlimactic, isn't it, this death?
No, anticlimactic is not the right word because there's actual suspense. I just think it turns into some of the deaths in the later slasher films where it's all just about creativity.
We see Arnie pull up to Darnell's and Junkins asks him where he was. Arnie says he was running an errand for Darnell and he wasn't home or at the garage last night. But Junkins says they found Darnell dead in Christine's seat with a shotgun by his side. And when they go around the corner, Christine is
in the shotgun seat.
Jesus. When they go around the corner, Christine is in perfect health, despite being on fire the night before. Arnie swears he doesn't know what's going on.
I mean, we've all eaten Taco Bell at 1 in the morning.
Right.
And you know all about being on fire late at night.
Arnie swears he doesn't know what's going on, and honestly, he has a hell of an alibi. Lee calls Dennis and says that she wants to talk to him, and in the book, these two do have an affair. They are together, And they kind of play that in the movie too, but they cut the majority of those scenes out. There's one scene where Arnie does see them making out in Dennis's car, or at least they're hugging in Dennis's car that he catches. But Adam, it's a wise choice to not have them have that affair here, right?
Yeah, I get that there's almost a little something, but it's not there, and I'm good with that. Especially if Arnie is so obsessed over Christine, is it just then he obsesses over everything? Because then it takes away from her. Does Christine kill him because she's jealous, because he's jealous? It would complicate things. There's enough with what's there. And look, they're both friends. I think they want Arnie to be okay, so I get that they would help him out, or that they would join forces, so to speak.
Well, yeah, it would have turned into, like, I didn't need this to be single white female. What a car.
Well, there is a love triangle going on, but it doesn't involve Dennis. It involves Christine between these three. Well,
because nobody likes a backseat driver.
Lee's asking Dennis about Christine, and he tells her all he's heard, and Lee says that she's supposed to be next, and Dennis says that Arnie would never do that. Lee says it's the car. And you know what? This is the one thing that Lee, the character, brings to that book. I don't like her in that book. I don't like her in this movie. But she is the first character in the book to say, you know what? There's something wrong with that car. It's not even Arnie's parents in the book that first realize it. It's her. But they even take that out here, so it makes her even more useless. And Lee warns Dennis to not go over to Arnie's for New Year's. She asks, what if the car won't let Arnie talk about what's going on? And Dennis replies, then we'll destroy it. We see Lee go and hide behind a tree as Arnie pulls up to Dennis's and Christine. And Arnie is laughing as Dennis comes out in crutches. Arnie tells Dennis to watch what he calls Christine, as she's very sensitive. We're seeing this crazy look in Arnie's eyes as he's driving the highway. And what about these two drinking in the car while driving?
Hey, the car drives itself.
Yeah.
Hey, David Hasselhoff did it in Knight Rider. Of course, an alcoholic gets cast at a show about a car that drives itself.
In the book, this is crazy, because in the book, Dennis is noticing Arnie drink beer after beer, not even getting drunk. All of this, and I do think, again, you can't read something about drinking in a Stephen King movie around this time and not think of him and his problems, and I do think he was kind of saying something with that. But here, it's kind of a frightening scene in the book. Here, it's Arnie just kind of acting like an asshole, right?
Yeah, he's full greaser at this point. Mm-hmm. Though I will say, this is the least annoying version of this stereotype in a Stephen King movie to me.
Yeah, but least annoying greaser is like saying the luckiest guy on death row. It doesn't really mean much.
Arnie, toast to the death of 1979 shitters in the world. And then Dennis is toast to friendship as Arnie takes his hand off the wheel. And of course, we can tell that Arnie has changed. Dennis says he's scared for Arnie. And Arnie says it's because he's jealous and he doesn't want to be one of the shitters who doesn't do what's good for them. Again, Arnie saying shitter here just doesn't make any sense.
You do it once or twice, it's fine. But he says shitters so much that they say bullshit in Ant-Man to get that thing a PG-13 rating. Shitters, 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 shitters. It loses its effectiveness after, I don't know, the 10th time I heard it.
By the way, it loses its effectiveness about 50 pages into this book, and it just keeps going and going for the next 600. So,
damn.
People, we didn't get it as much as we did in the book.
I really thought it was a movie thing.
No. Ugh. Dennis says Lee really cares for him. And if you can find somebody who believes in you, nothing can stop you. And of course, he's not talking about Lee. He's talking about Christine. And Arnie says what Bay said earlier, no shitter ever comes between him and Christine. And there's nothing finer than being behind the wheel of your own car. Well, except for maybe pussy.
I've been at campgrounds for weeks on end and not heard the word shitter get used this much.
I love that line, nothing finer than being behind the wheel of your own car.
Same. Yeah, because that is freedom,
stuck
right?
Out. Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that's a lot of Stephen King's obsession from a teenager to an early adult. There's just something about that. And in the time frame that this would have been done, that's true. It's a little different nowadays. You know, kids can use an app and go wherever they need to go with Uber and Lyft. But back then, especially small towns, you needed a car. Mm-hmm. And the freedom with that was unparalleled.
Yeah, except back when you guys did it, it was a horse and buggy.
Fuck you.
Oh, I touched a nerve there.
we see Dennis leaving a message on Christine and then head to his own car, and we cut to him sneaking in and opening the door for Lee to enter. Now, this finale is really different in the book. A, it's Arnie's dad who's in the front seat of Christine in the book, because Christine is just taunting them. And in the book, Arnie and his mom are out looking at colleges because Arnie's decided he's going to go ahead and go to college. So this is Christine driving herself. Also in the book, you guys are going to laugh your asses off. There's another sentient vehicle in the book. it's a purple big, I don't want to call it a bulldozer, but it's a huge vehicle that comes in, and it's pretty much girl on girl fights. These two vehicles are fighting each other, and the big purple fucking vehicle ends up winning.
It turns into like the automobile equivalent of the Maury Povich show.
Yes.
And there's people a green wonder why people criticize Stephen King's ideas
sometimes. I know. Although the very ending of this, we'll get to it, but I really like what he does at the very end of this.
Is that the same time that a green meteor decided to pass overhead of this town? I brought it back, folks. I remembered.
The one that drops the stuff in creep in his segment in Creepshow, the alien.
No, he was talking about Maximum Overdrive.
See, I love that movie, and I always forget that everything's caused by a fucking meteor.
Yes.
Same one that brings Audrey 2.
So what a plan they come up with here. And by the way, Dennis sure is walking well after struggling on crutches the week before, isn't he?
He's been in the hospital for 4 months. I hope he'd be recovered.
So they get in this bulldozer and it drives around a bit Steve Austin style. And
yeah, I was thinking of like a freaking like Zamboni.
Yeah. They sit and wait for Christine to come in the door. Dennis sends Lee to the office and says, wait until she gets in the door. And when she does, Lee needs to shut the door with them in it. Dennis assures Lee that if Arnie doesn't show up, Christine will. They repeat their intentions twice for the idiots who didn't get it the first time. Lee gets out, and we see the lights turn on behind her, which means Christine is on the attack. Lee jumps and grabs a beam above her as Christine drives below, and she ends up against a steel door as Dennis drives the bulldozer into the car. Christine is beat up and heads right to Lee, who doesn't move. And we're hearing "you shitter" shouted as Christine plows right into another wall and breaks the front end even more. Christine then kind of disappears with Arnie in the driver's seat and looking like a zombie. The headlights turn on and Dennis tries getting the bulldozer wired back up. The car crashes with Arnie emerging with a piece of glass stuck in his gut. And this was a scene that Carpenter actually added very late. It might have been just a couple months before that was actually released. Because in the first cut of this movie, Arnie goes flying through the windshield and that's the end of him. But Carpenter wanted to give him...
Yeah, the moral of the book is wear your seatbelt. In the same way that the moral of Pet Sematary is build a fence.
Yeah, and Carpenter was like, okay, I don't have much blood here. I don't have much, so let me add something. So they have this scene of him pulling this glass out of him and dying right in Lee's arms. I think Keith Gordon's, again, I think he's doing really well here. It's just kind of a weird death scene. Adam, do you agree with that?
Yeah, the way that Arnie's used here at the end, I don't think is great. I think this is... Surprise, they kind of flop a ending in a Stephen King movie. You know, I like the way a lot of this action is done. I like the way the bulldozer is chomping on Christine. I like that we kind of get teeth marks at Christine's grill at some point. That all makes sense to me. I don't know if Arnie is in here until almost like an insert shot to say, oh, there he is. And then you don't even see, suddenly the car crashes and then he's just laying there with glass in his, this giant shard in his belly. And I'm like, I didn't see him go through the windshield, didn't see him fall out of the car. He's just suddenly laying there with glass in him. And I'm waiting for something else to happen. No, he just dies. And I think the ending falls apart pretty bad for Arnie.
Well, something else does happen. He's dying while touching his girl. No, not Lee. He is getting one more touch in on Christine before he dies. I thought that was a really nice shot by Carpenter.
A little too histrionic for my taste, especially given it's kind of a contrast with the rest of the movie. And this is the ultimate tribute to Stephen King because the ending blows.
Again, I'll get to the ending of the book. Lee again walks and we're expecting those headlights to turn on yet again, but they don't as Lee tells Dennis that Arnie is dead. We're hearing "I'll Forever Love You for the Rest of My Days" play on the radio as Dennis rams Christine with the bulldozer. And we're getting this doom and gloom Carpenter theme as the car is just thrashed to bits. Love the shot of the bulldozer just running over the car as Lee is standing right in front of it. Nice shot there. The car again starts repairing itself, though, but Dennis again goes right over the top of it. And then our very next shot is seeing it dropped from above. Like, it turns into this block of metal, pretty much.
I thought I missed something.
Yeah.
Like, did I suddenly look at my phone and I forgot? It's felt weird. Yeah, I mean, even when they start running over the car and they think that's it, and then it starts to kind of inch its way towards Lee, and it's like, oh my God. And all they do is run over it again. I'm like, that. Okay. So I get it. It's just something's missing, you know, to connect it together. So it's a Stephen King ending. Paul Soley, because you could not find a way to land this plane.
It's literally tripping over your own feet at the finish line.
Junkins is standing with Dennis and Lee. And again, in the book, he's dead. So this scene is obviously added. He calls them heroes, and they say a real hero could have saved Arnie. And then we see George Thorogood himself walk by with a radio, and he uses it to have a line here, but Carpenter cut it to save George the embarrassment. They gave Thorogood a line, but Carpenter was like, you know what? You even delivered that line terribly, so he cut it. But I do like the fake out of the music being played, and then we cut into a boombox.
Yeah, because I think I'm going to see a light or hear music, and then I hear music, and I'm like, oh, there it is. Yeah. And then it's a fake out, which is good, but then you start to see some movement. I dig it.
Yeah, you think you would have heard like the engine rev up or something to kind of be like the closing tease, but no, I like that it's a fake out and a misdirect.
Instead, we hear Lee just say, God, I hate rock and roll. The only time I like anything she says in this movie is when she says that. As Bad to the Bone plays yet again, and credits roll on Christine. All right, guys, so in the book, there's an epilogue, and we're cutting to a couple years later. Dennis and Lee have broken up. See, they don't live happily ever after in the book. They have broken up. They've gone their separate ways. But Dennis picks up a paper, and he sees one of Buddy's old gang who had gotten away has been run over. And Dennis just knows that Christine is still out there, and he will be next. And I just love that bit of foreboding. I think that was a really good ending. I don't know how you would do it in movie form, but on the page, I think it works.
Yeah, they were setting up Christine to second gear.
All right, you shitters. What do you think of Christine on a scale of 1 to 10? Adam.
This is a movie I was a little worried about because it's got its champions, but it brought together a director that I really like in the way that his sensibilities with John Carpenter, and from the mind of a writer that I've had my qualms with, to be nice. But I think this movie, it's amazing that it still works today as well as it did in 43 years ago when we're recording this. Jesus, I'm old.
Wow.
Garrett's older. But I think the smart thing about this is for every Stephen King inclusion in this, I think it is softened and bettered by the director, by the team that did it. And I think at the end of the day, you get a movie that's pretty damn successful in its execution. You don't have everything explained, and I think that's smart. You are edited and cut away from things so that it doesn't go on too long. Quite smart. The music holds off until it needs to punctuate what's going on. And all that makes for a pretty damn effective film. I think Keith Gordon as Arnie, even though he, as I mentioned before, does a, you know, very quick turn from Revenge of the Nerds to freaking Phi Beta Kappa, he does a swell job in this. I actually like John Stockwell as Dennis. I think he's a put-on friend, does a good job. I really like Alexandra Paul, but I'm the only one. I could have used a little more with the brother to the original owner, even maybe having Evan Stanton investigate that family to what was going on, I think would have been a wise way to go. But I think the casting is done pretty well, other than them being too old. I get over that because I like the performances. I think the direction is pretty dang stellar and elevates kind of a rote Stephen King story. You know, it feels repetitive the way that we've done these, but I think Carpenter and team elevate it. I enjoyed watching this, and that's not something I get said for a lot of these. It's not wonderful, it's not great, but it is pretty damn solid. It is that reliable car right off the line. And if you haven't watched it in 5, 10, 20 years, give yourself a taste of Christine, because I think she'll make you happy. This is a solid 7 on 10. Really good time with it.
Wow, with the way you ended last week's podcast, I thought you were gonna go much lower. Interesting. Matt?
Before you do that, if you would have asked me before I rewatched it, that would have been my assumption as well. And I'm glad to say that this is one where I was, for not watching it since I was a teenager, I was happy to go back.
Yeah, this is the Chevy Malibu of movies, where it'll get you from A to B, and it's got good gas mileage, it's got good handling, because the person driving the car knows what the hell he's doing. This is kind of the good example of workman job for hire projects, which often is kind of a connotation for the director to say I was half-assing it, or just did it for the money. Granted, the latter was true, because John Carpenter was in the red after The Thing, but I think this goes to show that you can take something that's not yours, but put your flourishes on it. Because this is a John, it earns the John Carpenter's Christine assumption, to the point where I actually would say I like this better than the book. And look, there's been plenty of King, and will be plenty of King adaptations that I can say that about, but not all. While at the same time, I don't think it's one of like the best King adaptations or one of the best Carpenter films. It's kind of somewhere in between, where I think it's above average, But what hurts it for me is just, I don't think the story is all that great as far as the dissolution of friendship. And the Dennis character just does nothing for me, which is why he spends so much of it in a hospital bed, because it's almost like they've been recognized, we got nothing. And I'm kind of with Adam that it's a 7 on 10. Like, I really enjoy watching it. It's like driving down Route 66, where there's a lot of good scenery and some really cool stuff. But I just can't say it's like one of the best, quote unquote, King movies. But still an endorsement nonetheless, and certainly better than a lot of stuff John Carpenter would make after this movie.
So what was your final score? I'm sorry.
7.
You had 7 as well. I was dreading going back to this, honestly. I had very fond memories of it growing up. And again, as I mentioned, I've read, this is probably the Stephen King book I've read the most in my lifetime. I've read it 5 times. I read it the 6th time before this podcast.
I read it 6 times.
A different Carpenter film, thank you. It's just something I always return to. In watching it now and in reading it now, it has definitely lost some of its power with me. I had that teen angst that a lot of these teenagers have in this movie. Well, people playing teenagers have in this movie. And I do think that the miscasting of this hurts the film quite a bit. I think what holds the movie up is the direction of Carpenter. I always looked at this as a paycheck movie for him, because he has been out saying that it was a paycheck movie. And in watching it for this podcast, I was thinking, okay, how much am I going to see the seams here of Carpenter just trying to keep his career afloat? Well, he proves himself very well with this. And as me and Matt mentioned, I do think he's going back to his Halloween roots here by going low on the violence, but high on the tension. The movie's not scary. The movie's not going to frighten you. But Carpenter does his best to make the car feel foreboding each time it's on screen. And once again, Carpenter has a pretty decent score going on here. So I have a higher standard. I want to go 6 with this, which is what I had written down. I just think Alexandra Paul and John Stockwell hold this down pretty far for me. If you had put Kelly Preston in that Alexandra Paul role, in the role of Lee, I would have gone with this more. But I can't go with Alexandra Paul's deliveries in this movie. And there are some parts of this that just, as I mentioned, just don't make any sense in context with the book that he was adapting. I agree with a lot of decisions he's made here, but in contrast of what it turns Arnie into, it doesn't make sense, because in that book he's turned into the former owner. Here he's just kind of obsessed with the car. But if you knew me and Adam in high school, this is pretty much how we were when it came to girls, so maybe he's more accurate than we realize. But as it is, it's a 6 on 10. Guys, you know who was not a big fan of this movie?
King himself. He said it's one of the only two that bored him.
He says it bored him. He said it was something that he sold a manuscript to because he believed that it could be something that would be exciting. But yeah, this and The Shining bored him. Adam, this movie's not boring, is it?
I don't think so, but I could see maybe he didn't stick around for the second half of the movie.
Well, guess what? As with a lot of King properties, we could be getting another attempt at this.
Let me guess. Is Mike Flanagan doing this Mike one Flanagan. Too?
No. Close. Brian Fuller in 2021 had announced that he had acquired the rights and he had written a script, and King had read it and really liked it. And from what I remember, there were interviews with him around this time. He was full board with it, and he was teaming up with Blumhouse. They were putting it together. But there hasn't been much about this being reported since 2022. So I don't know if it's even going forward. Matt, you were a huge fan of the Hannibal TV series. Could Brian Fuller do something with this?
Well, I had to watch that Carrie thing he made.
Yeah.
I refer to it as the thing to keep with the theme of this show. But I don't want to say this is like overdue for a remake, but I'd be curious to see, because I don't think you could do the 50s anymore. It's too outdated. Like, it would be like the recent It movie where it'd be the 80s. Like, he'd be driving a DeLorean. Which, that'd be kind of cool, because it'd be playing on like nostalgia for both movies and cars. But outside of that, I don't know if it would garner enough interest from me to, or the masses for that matter.
Yeah. Although I'm with you though. I do think this is overdue. I think this could be improved upon. I do think that a remake of this could be a good movie. I think it could do good things. I would not scoff at the idea of a remake. And when I heard
Brian, as long as it's a movie, I don't want this to be a mini series or any of that nonsense. Just give me a 2-hour movie from Blumhouse and go from there.
Yeah, and I would endorse Brian Fuller doing this. I've liked a lot of his work.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, could you make a car killer car interesting? Yeah, maybe. I think Blumhouse might be the right place to do it because they're smart with, well, every other Blumhouse movie is smart with the way they use low budget. And I think that's what you kind of got to do with this. I don't want some flashy CGI monstrosity. I think they could do something pretty smart, but maybe. I mean, it was supposed to be out this year. So obviously that's not happening. So maybe 2 years from now, we'll be revisiting this. Still got
time. Yeah.
That's true. Hey, we got a Resident Evil trailer dropped out of nowhere that I didn't know existed. So yeah, maybe.
And with Blumhouse's ability to just shit out movies, it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, don't forget, this movie, in the 80s, it was conceived, directed, and released within about 8-9 months, which is extremely fast. So
sounds like Jason Blum.
Yeah, I was going to say, you give it in Blumhouse's hands in today's day and age, guess what? He could do it even faster. And I do believe that we could get something within the next couple years. All right, well, for those who listen to the end credits of this, you know that Matt does the schedule, but Matt, can I please announce what we're doing next? Because I'm excited.
Oh, yeah, take it, because this is one of your, your babies.
I made a special request at the beginning of this year and throughout the course of this year, because I've been wanting to do a property, even if it was for a one-off, I wouldn't have cared. We do franchises on this show. We try to find reasons to do franchises, but to do a one-off of this property would have really made no sense to do. But this year we are getting a new Masters of the Universe film, and I begged and pleaded, and Matt has agreed. We are doing the 1987 Canon Films, Masters of the Universe film. And then we are getting to, yes, the Travis Knight directed new Masters of the Universe He-Man movie that we are getting. I gotta tell you guys, look, Star Wars let me down. Indiana Jones let me down at the end of that podcast. But I'm looking at the trailers for this new He-Man movie. I'm seeing fun. And Adam, what are you expecting when we get to He-Man?
Yeah, I can't get El Mariachi or Hellboy, but I'm going to Eternia. Okay, yeah. You know what? I think there's some retro fun goodness to be had. I think Garrett and I, growing up at the time that original one came out, is going to be an interesting discussion. And as much as I want to roll my eyes, that new trailer for the new one coming out, casting aside, it made me feel nostalgic as well. So, God damn it. I have the power, and you know what? Come on, Cringer. Let's go. I'm ready.
Matt, were you feeling going into He-Man, sir?
I was at the game on this podcast has the least desire to talk about He-Man. I am as out of my depth in this as I would be trying to get a chick at a bar. Not my territory. This is not my generation. And, you know, I like hyper fantasy, but this is not a property that I have any attachment to, both as a youth or nowadays. I mean, I've seen the Canon movie, but I'm not as excited about this new movie as seemingly you two are.
You're looking at trailers for this. Are you at least a little bit excited for this new movie coming out?
No, because I don't know what to make of it. Because I don't have that lens of like, oh, they're doing this. It's more faithful, to use that word. I don't have that frame of reference. But if I'm just looking at it as modern fantasy movies, it just looks like stuff I've seen before, just with that property at the helm. And I'm not excited about some of the casting.
All right. Well, I can't wait to do those shows. I'm really stoked to talk about that property. And I'm sure it's probably going to be 85% me and Adam talking about He-Man, and poor Matt just kind of sitting in the back saying, yeah. And you know what? We're going to come back to King. As I've mentioned, we did do this a little out of order. I understand that before Christine was supposed to be Creepshow, but you know what? I didn't want these guys to do four more of these movies in a row. And these last set of podcasts that we've done, Matt, these have been pretty rough, man. We've gone to some deep depths with these last few King movies, haven't we?
Yeah, we're jumping through the valleys to the point where I may need knee replacement surgery.
My goodness.
They've run the gamut, and yeah, they put us through something.
I've been really proud of this set of shows that we've done. But until next week, this podcast has the smell of a brand new car, and that's about the finest smell in the world. Well, except for maybe pussy. Thank you, boys.
I'm not going in that car again. Oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. Don't you blame your choking on Christine.
It happened, Arnie. When I choked, something happened. The radio came on. Everything got bright.
So what are you saying?
I could have died, Arnie. You didn't even help.
My door was locked.
You didn't want that man to help me either.
I thought he was attacking you. I didn't know he was going to do the Heimlich maneuver. I could have done the Heimlich maneuver.
But you didn't.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
The riot is over.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
That's noise pollution, what you're doing.
You don't know half as much as you think you do.
Shitter.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Indiana Jones, the films featuring the team-up of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Mad Max film series, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Megan films, the Black Phone films, and so much more.
Look, I know you ain't exactly got money falling out of your asshole.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Has it ever occurred to you that part of being a parent is trying to kill your kids?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
We'll show those shitters what we can do.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Ship wipes off.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, Arnie, I was thinking.
Scheduling done by Matt.
A hell of a job.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
No, Papa, you can't polish a turret.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
I wouldn't feel so bad if I were you. You two are heroes, you know.
Yeah. Real hero could have saved Arnie.
We didn't do so hot.
Hey, some things can't be helped. Some people, too.
Yeah.
break it up. Come on, break it up right now. Okay, you kids take a walk. Come on, take a walk. Get lost.
But yeah, this is definitely the biggest, like, closest to a paycheck thing he would ever make. Although I will say, I think there's more inspiration in this movie than certainly some of his later work that he may have felt more passionate about, like Vampires, where, yeah, his name's on it. But I think that that's a really compromised movie, and I wish I liked it more than I did.
Ooh, we might have words about
that'd
that.
That'd be fun to do.
That would be a fun one. Me and Adam saw that in theaters, and I think we watched it over and over.
All right. Little Teak Padre.
All right, Adam. We're finally getting to talk about John Carpenter.
Because you can find this font on Word. It's like Ambrose or something, but it's the John Carpenter font. So when you own text, that goes to show your stamp has a lot of power behind it.
And this tradition has actually been carried on very well by Lee Cronin, hasn't it, Matt?
Now that we've seen his the first movie he put his name on, and that would be, if we ever do that as a Patreon review, I will.
One of these days, if we
will have to do it when as part of the Evil Dead tie-in, because that's the basically what got him the job.
Yeah, one of these days, if we ever do that, we gotta post our text conversation right after I got out of it. So I was laughing all the way home at that. All right, so Adam, what do you think of hearing George Thorogood here?
I had to remind myself that it's new, but this is, I don't think there's a more overused song.
There's tough. A big one you're missing. If I have to hear La Freak in one more movie, I'm going to scream. Not just because it's going to be in the next podcast that we tape right after this.
But it's just...
Even though he doesn't have a lot of his regular collaborators on here, there are still all of his, like, directing touches that are here. Because it's weird, like, to watch a John Carpenter movie with no, like, Peter Jason or... Who was it early on in his career? Fucking name.
I don't know.
George Buckflower.
Buckflower, yeah. Adam, as the Carpenter fan, you must have noticed how good the directing is here, right?
Yeah, and this... Yeah, he was in a lot of Michael Mann's early films.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it is weird that you have both the owner... And then the, what do you call it? The other, God, I'm drawing a blank. Yeah, it's just an odd inclusion to have both of them.
So Lee's eating this burger. She starts choking when the lights turn on and Arnie can't get in to help her. She is then grabbed by a hitchhiker.
Been there.
What's that?
Been there. I'm talking about choking out a cheeseburger.
She is then grabbed by a stranger.
And this reminds me of a lot of, like, it feels like almost something that they were forced to include. Like, I was thinking of movies like Brain Scan with the Frank Langella detective, where it's like, I get why you're here, because you have to have someone, like, doing the legwork to try to piece this together, but this should have happened a lot earlier.
Oh, you said Brain Scan. I thought you were talking about the one with Edward Furlong.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Is that
Frank Langella plays the detective?
Oh, okay. Because who's the one with Walken? That was Brainstorm, right?
That could be any number of things.
Yeah,
there was a period where that man said no to nothing.
Yeah, Arnie tries passing off.
Yeah, it's literally. And I was going to laugh when I say this. It's the episode in South Park with the old people driving, and they hide in the decrepit house, and the car drives up the stairs.
I was going to, there's an episode of American Dad where...
Oh, Roger?
Roger, yes.
With the limo?
Yep. Oh, God. Bear's completely out of it.
That porn.
This podcast has more bloopers than a fucking Toy Story movie. Adam, how'd you...